Welcome to the KSTE Farm Hour. Here's KSTE's Farmer Fred, Fred Hoffman.
Larger than the state of Delaware. That's the description of the number of acres burned in California's recent lightning-started wildfires, decimating many Northern California counties, and that's including a lot of farms, ranches, vineyards, and orchards. The damage is still being registered, but we have an update, along with information about an upcoming webinar put on by the University of California designed to help small and large agricultural operations, as well as small acreage landowners, learn about restoration and erosion control options, as well as financial assistance programs. Hey, there's good news. There's a nut glut. Record harvests of almonds, walnuts, and pistachios are expected. The bad news? Who's going to buy all those nuts? We explain. We're coming up to cover cropping time. We'll go over the basics. We have all that, crop reports, the week ahead in weather, and a lot more on this week's KSTE Farm Hour. Let's get started. In the wake of wildfires scorching parts of Northern California, affected farmers and ranchers are working to rebuild irrigation systems and take other steps to save remaining crops and commodities. The California Farm Bureau Federation reports that farmers in the path of the wildfires face costs to rebuild or replace damaged structures and equipment. The fires have also burned thousands of acres of grazing land, leaving ranchers with difficult decisions about managing their livestock. And there are losses in the smaller livestock sector as well. Beekeepers in the region around Vacaville say the LNU Lightning Complex fire caused severe losses that threaten their businesses and their ability to provide pollination services to almonds and other crops. In part, that's because the fires hit at a time of the year when beekeepers repopulate their colonies for almond pollination for the following February. The fires also damaged or destroyed bee habitat and forage. Well, the livestock that can be wrangled are headed to California's state and county fairgrounds. As wildfires continue to burn in California, local fairgrounds are fulfilling their mission to offer resources during times of crisis by providing shelter for people and animals, as well as base camp facilities for firefighters. The fairs that have provided assistance include Santa Cruz, Sonoma Marin, Napa, Alameda, Salinas Valley, Sonoma County, Plumas Sierra, Tehama, Modoc, Lassen, Solano, Glen, San Mateo, Siskiyou, Monterey County, the Silver Dollar Fairgrounds in Chico, the Napa Valley Exposition, the Dixon May Fair, the Motherlode Fairgrounds in Sonora, the Cow Palace, and the Calaveras County Fair and Jumping Frog Jubilee. Evacuees are being housed in fairground buildings as well as on on-site RV parks, and animals being sheltered included horses, cattle, llamas, pigs, chickens, goats, sheep, ducks, geese, mules, and peacocks. Nine of those fairgrounds, by the way, are also hosting fire crews. And it isn't just flames that has California's farming community worried. It's the smoke. Not only are there concerns for the health of farm workers, but grape crops in the Sonoma area face an uncertain future. Ross Reedy is the director of winemaking for VML and Truett Hurst Winery in Healdsburg. He told Business Insider that fire isn't our only worry, it's smoke taint.
You know, if you have smoke that sits in a vineyard over a period of time, it latches onto the skins and the sugar. It actually creates like very heavy barbecue, ashtray kind of characteristics in the wines. Depending on what the winds do and what this fire does, there's a real big chance that we're not gonna be able to harvest fruit this year, which would be really bad.
Here's an update on the fire situation. The LNU complex fire in Napa, Lake, Sonoma, Solano, and Yolo counties has burned over 375,000 acres. It's 81% contained. The SCU Lightning Complex fire in Contra Costa, Alameda, Santa Clara, and Stanislaus counties, 391,000 acres, and that's 78% contained. Other fires still raging include the CZU August Lightning fire in San Mateo and Santa Cruz counties, 85,000 acres burned, 48% contained. And up in Butte, Tehama, and Glen counties, the BTU-TGU Lightning Complex fire is raging, 64,000 acres burned up that way, 45% contained. University of California Ag and Natural Resources has an online seminar coming up about what to do on the land, what to avoid after the LNU fire that has affected Napa, Lake, Sonoma, Solano, and Yolo counties. This online program will be held from 9 a.m. to 12:30 on Thursday, September 10th. Small acreage landowners and small to large ag operations are encouraged to register for this free webinar to learn about fire impacts on oak woodlands, rangelands, orchards, and vineyards, in addition to restoration and erosion control options and financial assistance programs. You can register. It's free, by the way. Register at ucanr.edu/LNUfire.
The deadline is approaching for farmers and ranchers to apply for USDA's Coronavirus Food Assistance Program.
Everything U.S. government has to have an acronym. It's CFAP. The first $16 billion in this funding is a form of direct payments to farmers to help them through those tough times.
Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue made his comments to the National Association of State Directors of Agriculture.
So we want to get that money out quickly, and that money really went through April 15th for the damages incurred in the first quarter, essentially there.
For producers of more than 160 commodities, the deadline to apply is September 11th, 2020.
Through this entire process, we've tried to listen to our producers and adding additional commodities to what's being covered. As I indicated, we're gearing up to announce CFAP Round 2, which will incorporate more of the feedback to make a program that works best for the people who truly need it.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The Western Farm Press is reporting that sometimes too much of a good thing can actually end up being too much of a good thing, and indications are that this year's tree nut bounty may end up being a real nut glut, with prices in some cases at or below the cost of production. This year's California almond crop is forecast to climb nearly 20% to record heights, something like 3 billion pounds of almonds. At the same time, almond export opportunities are drying up because of trade wars. Pistachio growers are seeing their production headed toward an all-time high as well, with a billion pounds. While prices are projected to drop into the $2.30 to $2.40 range per pound, the walnut industry finds itself in similar straits. The acreage of tree nut varieties rose prolifically between 2007 and 2019, and many new orchards are still just coming online. Industry analysts at Rabobank International note that prices could get below the cost of production. This year's almond harvest is predicted to be the largest crop on record. The USDA is forecasting a yield of 2,300 pounds per acre. That's more than 200 pounds per acre higher than the 2019 yield. According to information from the Almond Board of California, minimal carryover of year-to-year almond inventory is expected to be about 340 million pounds. That's like 2 months' worth of inventory. But the Almond Board says even if trade agreement hiccups remain unresolved this fall, there will still be plenty of storage space available. Bloomberg News quotes fourth-generation California walnut grower Bill Carrera saying that young trees planted 5 years ago are now hitting production. It's going to be a big crop now and for the next few years. Carrera also sits on the California Walnut Board and the state's Walnut Commission, and he says, "We're nervous where prices are, but once new trees are in, you're in it for 40 to 50 years. You just have to suck it up, grit your teeth, and get through it." Here's this week's California Crop Report. Fires continued to burn throughout the state, resulting in poor air quality as smoke and haze permeated the air. In Tulare County, harvested fields were being disked and planted for silage or other forage crops. Silage corn is in various stages of maturity. Alfalfa is maturing and continues to be harvested. Cotton bolls continue to develop. Rice growers are preparing for the upcoming harvest. Sunflower harvest began in some fields. Alfalfa harvest continues in Fresno County with normal drying conditions. In Yolo County, sunflowers were drying out in prep for harvest. Air quality affected harvest activities around areas where fires were present. Persimmon, kiwi, and pomegranate maturation continues. Table grape varieties and wine grapes are being harvested, with smoke taint remaining a cause of concern in some areas due to recent fires. Nectarines, apricots, peaches, plums, lemons, grapefruit, and orange harvest is ongoing. Olive orchards continue to be pruned to thin trees where necessary. The blueberry harvest is steady. Almond harvest continues with reports of good yields and quality. Walnuts were irrigated. Pistachios continue to mature. In Tulare County, summer vegetables continued to grow and the fields were being prepped for harvest. Early planted melons were being picked and shipped domestically. Eggplant, peppers, sweet corn, and tomatoes continued to mature and be harvested. In Colusa, Fresno, Sacramento, and Solano counties, processing tomato harvest continues. Red bell pepper harvest is ongoing in Fresno County, less sunburned than normal due to the intense smoke from the wildfires. In Yolo County, processing tomato fields were being disked after harvest. Irrigated pasture was in good to excellent condition. Foothill rangeland and non-irrigated pasture was in fair to poor condition and continues to decline in quality. Wildland fires continue across the state, consuming some foothill range and forcing livestock evacuations in several locations. Cattle and sheep are grazing on retired cropland or harvested grain fields. Cattle supplemental feeding continues. Bees are still busy in the squash and melon fields. Autumn officially begins in just a little over 2 weeks, but you wouldn't know that by the weather ahead. Taking a look at the forecast for the southern Sacramento and northern San Joaquin valleys from September the 8th through the 14th, it's going to start off hot on Tuesday with a high of 103. Sunny skies for the entire week. Highs for the most part will be in the low to mid 90s, overnight lows in the 60s. Heat waves during the growing season have reduced the size of the processing tomato crop here in the Sacramento Valley, but crop estimators still expect the harvest to be slightly larger than last year. The California Farm Bureau Federation reports that farmers say they believe the heat may reduce per-acre crop yields, but they still anticipate a good-sized supply for use in tomato products. Marketers say those products have sold well during the pandemic as people seek foods to cook at home.
The Department of Agriculture this week updated trade data tracking export sales to China. American Farm Bureau Federation economist Veronica Nye says China has increased purchases of U.S. farm products, but is not on pace to reach commitments made in the Phase 1 trade agreement.
Certainly China is picking up the pace on their purchases, just as we were expecting them to, but there's still a long ways to go before they're on pace to actually meet their goal. So far, sales to China are nearly $8 billion. That's January through July. But unfortunately, that's still 44% below the pace needed for them to reach the Phase 1 goals.
Nye says the additional sales to China are not increasing U.S. ag exports this year.
It's basically just shifting where our exports are going. So January through July of 2020, our total exports are around $75.9 billion. That compares to January through July of 2019, where our sales were $78.6 billion. So we're down about $2.6 billion in exports this year compared to last year, which is about a 3% decline.
Additionally, Nye says trade talks with Taiwan, a top 10 market for U.S. agriculture, provides opportunity for U.S. farmers to expand trade in the future.
Being able to get back into that market would be very beneficial to the U.S. Taiwan has also said that they're willing to consider accepting beef from the United States from cows that are 30 months or older, which most of the world has already moved to. But that certainly would be a big benefit to U.S. beef producers. So there's lots of things like that that could certainly be improved in the U.S.-Taiwan relationship.
You can find more trade data on the Market Intel page at fb.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue had encouraging words about the Phase 1 trade deal with China.
Phase 1 with China got off to a fairly slow start. It really was just signed in early February, and then the world got overwhelmed with the pandemic of COVID. But I can tell you, over the last 6 weeks, they really stepped up.
He spoke to the National Association of State Directors of Agriculture.
You've seen record corn shipments and even bean shipments here recently. I believe they have the capacity. China imports a lot of things.
He says he expects Chinese demand for U.S. ag products will be strong as the Asian country rebuilds its swine herds.
As you see the crop coming on, for the most part, we've got the tragedy in Iowa with the windstorm, and we'll always have other issues in other parts of the country, Louisiana and hurricane. But for the most part, the crop that's coming on looks like we're going to need a strong export run.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is California Department of Food and Agriculture Secretary Karen Ross.
So at a time when farmers and farm workers are working so hard, it's important that we, as their neighbors and consumers and people who enjoy all of the fresh, bountiful produce and meats and flours and dairy products that California agriculture produces, it's important that we look for California and buy California. There's nothing better than visiting a farmer's market. My favorite one is on Sunday mornings under the freeway. Farmers markets look different now. They're socially distancing, there are fewer booths, there's not all the music and some of the things that make it more like a festival on Sunday mornings. But the farmers are there with the fresh food. So visit a farmer's market. Many people are now buying directly from farmers. Farmers who didn't have a website have rapidly developed their platform, and they have a booming business of people who want to do subscription boxes as a way of getting whatever is the freshest for that week and having a delivery point where they can pick it up. And of course, when you go to the marketplace, you can look for California grown on the label. So we can all keep ourselves safe by following those basic guidelines that have been out there from the beginning. Social distancing, at least 6 feet apart. Using face coverings, and there's lots of very cool designs that have been developed because we're Americans, we're creative. Washing your hands frequently. Hand sanitizer when you can't have warm water and soap, but wash your hands for at least 20 seconds. Those are the real basic things that we can do. Being very common sense, practical, but social distancing, frequent hand washing, face coverings when you go out. So when you go to the grocery store, you can look for the California Grown logo. That's evident, especially in the cut flower department. But also look for the signage that has California Grown or where the produce is from. If you don't see that there, ask your retailer. Ask for them, is this California Grown? I'm looking for California Grown produce. That's a good signal to them that they need to have California Grown in the produce sector. Obviously, when you go to the wine aisle, it's very evident right on the front that it's a product of California or another place. Real milk from California will tell you right there in the milk department and on cheeses. It's pretty easy when you get accustomed to looking for that point of origin to find it on the package. So we have tips for shoppers on how to find California Grown by visiting our new website. It's buycagrown.com. It'll give you the tips on what to look for and how to ask for it at your retail setting or even when you're shopping online.
That again was Karen Ross, Secretary of the California Department of Food and Agriculture. And that website again, buycagrown.com.
It doesn't happen nearly as much as it used to do 30, 40 years ago, but it still can be a problem in some areas, in some situations. A farmer puts fertilizer on his field in the form of nitrogen or phosphorus compounds following the EPA's directions about when and how to apply that fertilizer. Or even a homeowner fertilizes his or her lawn or garden. The idea is for the fertilizer, of course, to stay in the soil near the crops to be used by the plants to grow and then to just disappear. But sometimes, and this is just one example, after the fertilizer is put down, a rainstorm or a series of rainstorms falls on that field or yard, and the water going into the soil or running off the soil carries with it some of that fertilizer. And then sometimes, as outlined by the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, Andrew Wheeler,
excess nitrogen and phosphorus from fertilizer can reach watersheds and harm downstream resources of all kinds, including larger water bodies such as the Chesapeake Bay and the Gulf of Mexico. And in some areas, excess nutrients can threaten drinking water sources.
EPA does not want that to happen. Farmers don't want it to happen. And so
this is a great effort to do more with less, which is really the story of American agriculture.
And no other country matches the productivity of the American farmer.
First Voice there, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue, and then, of course, EPA Administrator Wheeler jointly announcing what they call the next-gen fertilizer challenges, next-generation fertilizer, two competitive programs designed to boost productivity through more efficient use of current fertilizers and development of new environmentally friendly ways to fertilize crops. Secretary Perdue told reporters these two competitive challenges fit right in with his innovation agenda that he announced back in February, the goal of which is increasing agricultural and food production by 40% while cutting agriculture's environmental footprint by 50% and doing it all within 30 years.
The only way we're going to achieve that is by doing what we're doing here today, and that's developing new innovative technologies that can maximize agricultural outputs while also improving the environment.
So these two challenges are for researchers and others to submit ideas and projects with that in mind. And EPA's Andrew Wheeler says if this is successful,
this challenge will result in lower cost to farmers and consumers, while at the same time will help keep fertilizers where they are needed, on corn and other agricultural fields and out of our waterways.
And if you're interested in reading more about these challenges and what they'll do, or maybe even entering the competition, go online, search Next Gen Fertilizer Challenges. Next Gen Fertilizer Challenges. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
As they begin their harvest this month, California's walnut farmers anticipate record crops from their orchards. The U.S. Agriculture Department forecasts a harvest of 780,000 tons. Walnut marketers say they're preparing to sell a larger crop. The California Walnut Board and Commission says it will encourage Americans to eat more walnuts as snacks while working to expand export markets in Europe and Asia.
The continuing efforts of the farm community to communicate what agriculture is all about and why it is important to everyone grow more important each day. And that means utilizing a variety of strategies and innovations to facilitate education and dialogue, whether it's social media.
We see social media as a growing area of opportunity for producers to really embrace.
And other web-based tools to basic one-on-one, down-on-the-farm discussion, visits, and experiences.
We do open our farm up 365. 5 days a year. They come feed the calves, watch the cows being milked. We give a lot of tours.
I'm Rod Bate. Anna Thompson-Weeman of the Animal Agriculture Alliance and Maryland dairy farmer Ben Sowers are among those joining us in a look at explaining the ag experience to all in this edition of Agriculture USA. Until recent years, many farmers and ranchers perhaps possessed this thought process regarding communicating what they do and how they do it to the public at large.
I don't have time for this, or I didn't go into farming because I want to communicate.
Farmers didn't get into this profession in order to talk to humans.
Yet ag industry members like Hannah Thompson-Weeman of the Animal Agriculture Alliance and Sarah Macedo of Crop Life America say with the growing interest by consumers of their food's origins and the entire value chain from farm to fork, the entire ag sector must not only communicate with consumers on several levels, but
it's so important for us to understand who our consumer is, understand where they're going for information, and figuring out how we can make sure we are very easily accessible and easily found.
Part of that has been explaining agriculture at the farm level via various internet platforms like blogs and websites and social media tools. Thompson-Weeman says one challenge for producers using digital communication is crossing and connecting platforms to reach all consumers.
I think us in agriculture, we have all these great blogs and white papers and research papers, but they're tucked away on our website. They're not really out there on Instagram or Snapchat or Facebook where people might be naturally looking for and getting information served to them.
Likewise, a growing number of commodity organizations and agribusinesses have been using web-based videos, both recorded and produced, and live streams as an education tool for the public. In the case of videos produced by Crop Life and shown on YouTube, Sarah Macedo says humor, mixed with message, is getting views from both ag and non-ag types.
We've had a lot of folks who have been adversarial in the past actually say, hey, we don't necessarily agree, but these are actually funny and get the point across.
Others in the farm sector prefer direct engagement with consumers. Wisconsin dairy farmer Lauren Bray says she relates with consumers in discussions about ag because, after all,
we all are consumers. We all are customers of farmers. We all consume food. I'm especially passionate about cooking and animal care, so it's fun to connect on values and talk to people about what they're interested in and then connect that back to agriculture. So whatever their questions are, we can always find common ground.
Then there is the approach of the producer being directly involved in the communities they live and work in. Hannah Thompson-Weeman says it's just
being a face in your community also goes a long way. So being involved in local civic organizations, speaking at your children's school, sponsoring a local sporting event, all those types of ways you can put a face on an industry that a lot of people don't have a direct connection with.
Lauren Bray and others in the ag sector say transparency in communicating the whys and hows of farming and ranching to consumers is essential. For instance, a conversation involving Bray in which new non-farm friends wanted to know about struggles in the dairy industry.
I took that opportunity to talk about why farms grow to be larger. In particular, on our farm, we have grown because we're supporting more than one family. So farms need to grow just like any other business. So it was a really fun conversation.
Some producers even go farther, inviting consumers to their farm or ranch. Perhaps it's in the form of agritourism or a formal farm tour. Or in the case of Maryland dairy grower Ben Sowers at his family farm.
You can come see us. Our farm is open all the time. You can meet us. We're always there. And we try to educate the differences. Organic's no better than non-organic. GMO's not better than non-GMO. It's how you perceive it and how you want to feed your children and how you want to feed yourselves. There's a marketplace for each one of those things.
Sarah Macedo agrees that the diversity of agriculture and its many forms and products is an essential part of the story that producers need to tell the world.
Because that's also the other part of it. Agriculture is so nuanced. There's so much detail. There's no message that can distill it down to like a 5-second soundbite. So you need all of these materials and everyone to tell their story of all growing methods, whether you're growing organically or non-organic. You just got to get out there and tell your story about why and how you're doing it.
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Educating consumers is more important than it's ever been. Foundation for Agriculture Executive Director Daniel Molloy says their educational materials are targeted at children trying to close the gap between urban and rural areas even before that gap begins.
What we do is get those into the hands of teachers and classroom volunteers so that they can educate kids before they become detached. Make sure that kids are learning all about where their food comes from before we even hit that detachment mark.
Molloy says one easy way for farmers to help educate the non-farm public is to do some school visits.
It is really effective when kids can actually hear from a real-life farmer or rancher, hear what they do, and get to meet somebody who's actually doing that work. And it's even better when that farmer or rancher can come in with education resources, something like our brand new book of the year, all about soybeans, called Full of Beans, Henry Ford Grows a Car.
Molloy says farmers and ranchers shouldn't be afraid to step out and educate the non-farm public about modern agriculture. He says consumers are genuinely curious about where their food comes from.
Who's growing it, how they're growing it, why they're growing it that way. When it comes down to it, we all really do share the same values. We care about the environment. We want clean water, healthy soil. We want our animals to be well cared for. It's important for us to share the foundation's education resources and then to encourage conversations so we can bridge that divide between consumers and agriculture.
Chad Smith, Washington.
Don't forget the KSTE Farm Hour is available on your schedule. You can listen to it live, of course, at 6:50 on the AM dial here in Northern California, or stream it live via the iHeartRadio app. And of course, the KSTE Farm Hour is available as a podcast. Download it from your favorite third-party podcast aggregator, and that includes the iHeartRadio app, Apple Music, and Google Play. If you've never experimented with cover crops, there are a lot of benefits for putting in what's called a cover crop during the fall for both gardeners and farmers. We're talking with the product development manager at Peaceful Valley Farm Supply in Grass Valley, Sarah Griffin Bubakar. And Sarah, what exactly are the benefits to cover cropping that people may not know about?
Well, there's a lot of benefits. It depends on why you want a cover crop. So there's lots of different reasons to use one. They can obviously fix nitrogen. That'd probably be the number one benefit. It brings atmospheric nitrogen and puts it right in the soil, right where your plants can use it. It also adds organic matter. So when you're amending your garden, the only two expensive amendments are nitrogen, fertilizer, and organic matter like compost. So this cover crop will do both of those. It also can suppress weeds over the winter and improve soil tilth and increase biology in the soil. It can reduce erosion. It can help with certain pest problems because it'll harbor beneficial insects. It can even provide winter feed for animals, helps with crop rotation, which is very important, and it's more of a natural crop rotation, and it can increase water infiltration in the soil.
Let's talk about that last point, because that's important for gardeners and farmers who want to cut down the amount of irrigation they have to do. And that has to do with the deep-rooted nature of cover cropping, allowing the water to penetrate even deeper into the soil profile.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, it can be, especially some cover crops have very large roots, like daikon radish. So you can plant daikon radish, and as it grows, it busts through some hard soils that would otherwise be hard to penetrate and allow the water to go down deeper into the soil profile. While at the same time, all of those roots and all of that organic matter is like a sponge holding on to water. So if you have a healthy cover cropping system, then yeah, over time you would need to irrigate less and less.
And as you mentioned, that by having a cover crop, you're providing, if you will, a good bug hotel for beneficial insects who may be inspired to spend the winter on your property.
Absolutely. Cover crop doesn't necessarily have to mean a crop you put in between, you know, your succession planting. It can also be a hedgerow, so something along the borderlines of your garden area or your farming area that would work as a protective area for these beneficial insects. So it can provide pollen for the pollinizing. A lot of our beneficial insects are pollinators when they're adults, and they're voracious bug eaters as larvae. And so it'll provide habitat for them, so that if you do have a pest problem in your garden, those beneficial insects are just lying in wait, waiting to gobble them up.
There's a lot of confusion among gardeners and farmers about when you take out a cover crop, or what do you do to a cover crop in spring when it's time to plant. Do you take it out? Do you just mow it down? What do you do with a cover crop? And at what point should you be cutting down a cover crop?
Right. Well, that's a really good question. So there's a couple of different schools of thought on that. There's if you're a tiller, if you till, then there's one way to do it. And then there's if you're a no-till person. And no-till is pretty hip right now because of the, you know, maintaining the mycorrhizae in the soil. And so if you till, then you bust up all that mycorrhizae, and it's hard for it to really get established, mycorrhizae being the beneficial fungus in the soil. So the no-till method is pretty popular. But the key thing to remember, whether you're tilling or not tilling, is that you don't want to cut the cover crop and just let it lay. Because if you let it lay, then all of that nitrogen that's in the plant, it's been sequestering, it's been grabbing from the atmosphere and putting it into the plant, it's all just going to go back into the atmosphere. And it can happen within minutes. Within an hour, most of that nitrogen's gone. So the key thing is that once you cut, you have to cover it, whether you cover it by tilling it into the soil, or whether if you're doing a no-till, then you're going to cover it with another layer of something. So finished compost or something else. So just to keep that nitrogen in the soil rather than going back into the atmosphere. So the key is to cut the cover crop when it's about half in bloom, because if you allow the cover crop to go to seed, then you've got weed problems, and not to mention a lot of that nitrogen that you've been taking from the atmosphere is now going into seed production. So all that energy, rather than going back into the soil as now fertilizer or green manure, is then going into seed production. So you don't want your cover crop to go to seed. So the key is to cut it when it's about half in bloom. So you just start to notice the blooms, about half the crop is in bloom, then you're going to cut it and immediately cover it, whether you're covering it by tilling it in or covering it with a mulch. Then you're going to wait at least 3 weeks. If you're tilling, perhaps even longer, depending on how thick your mat is. If you're doing a no-till, you're going to wait at least 3 weeks in planting to give the green manure a chance to break down. If you don't do that, it actually gets quite hot in the soil, and you can burn your seedlings or your seeds, and nothing will grow for about 3 weeks until that's able to break down. It could be sooner, could be longer, depending on how active the soil biology is at the time.
For both the small-scale gardener and the large-scale farmer, what are some alternatives for mulching that cut cover crop if you're practicing no-till?
I mean, you you can use straw, you can use alfalfa hay, you can use a finished compost, anything to cover up that layer of the green cover crop. You just really don't want it to go limp and have all the water come out of it, because with the water will go the nitrogen.
Let's talk about some various cover crops. And I imagine it depends on what you're growing and where you are and what sort of soil you have. But among the fall-sown cover crops, what are the most popular?
Well, we have formulated, here at Peaceful Valley, we formulated a couple of mixes that are really popular. We call them soil builder mixes, because they will build your soil if you use them every year. And the soil builder mixes have a mix of grasses and legumes. So the legumes are those nitrogen fixers. So that's the ones that we've mainly been talking about as fixing nitrogen. But grasses also have a lot of benefits, mainly being just a lot of biomass that they grow quickly and put a lot of organic matter into the soil. Soil builder mixes have vetch and bell beans, which are a kind of fava bean. So they grow really well in the cold weather. And the vetch is like a vine, and it climbs up the bell beans, and it climbs up. There's also white oats and peas in there, and the peas and the vetch use the oats and the bell beans as scaffolding to climb up. So it'll be quite the tangled mess, ideally. It'll be full of beneficial insects, ideally. And then when you chop it down, you want to do that before it's fully blooming.
And I imagine when you chop it down, you want to do it in segments of no more than 6 to 12 inches before you take it to the ground.
Right. Well, hopefully by the spring, your cover crop is quite lush and prolific. And so you want to chop it up as much as possible, because the more it's chopped up into little pieces, the quicker it breaks down. And so you will chop it up and then either till it in or cover it up.
So maybe mowing it after you've chopped it up would help.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Key is to really cover it up.
This mix that you're talking about, your premium soil builder mix, can get rather high, can't it? About what, 4 to 6 feet?
It can, yeah. So what I use is a weed whacker when I go to chop it down. And I'll just chop, like you said, the top 6 inches, then do another layer, then do another layer until it gets down to the ground.
And what is the application rate for the garden? What is the application rate for a farm?
Let's see, you're going to do 3 to 5 pounds for 1,000 square feet for the soil builder mix, keeping in mind that because it is a lot of different sized seeds, seed spreaders can be a little bit challenging, because you've got the smaller vetch seeds and the larger bell beans and that. So it will be a little bit harder to spread. Also, it's not pre-inoculated. And so if you add the inoculant, it can get a little bit sticky. So I usually just spread it by hand. Now, if you're a farmer, it's 70 to 120 pounds per acre, depending on how rich your soil is. Obviously, if your soil is quite poor, you're going to go the higher application rate. In that case, using a more professional grade seed spreader would be best, or even a seed driller. If you're drilling the seed, then it would be, you could go the lower application rate as well, because you'd have more germination.
What depth is ideal for planting the seed?
Well, because it's tough, like I said, because it's so many different sized seeds, you don't want to go too deep. So I would only go about 1/4 inch deep, because of the vetch mainly as the smallest seeds and the oats as well. So you don't want to go too deep. I'd say 1/4 inch to 1/2 inch deep at the most. A lot of people just spread it over the top, and that works too.
Does it need irrigation after planting, or can you just wait for the fall rains to begin?
It really depends. A big mistake, what I see a lot of people do, I just didn't have success with my cover crop. Well, usually it has to do with irrigation, because it is a seed that needs to, it needs to be completely moist the whole time. And so if it's allowed to dry out, then the seed will just die. And so I like to time it right when the fall rains have started, but the soil is still warm. If the soil is too cold when you plant it, then the seeds won't germinate, or they'll take a really long time to germinate. So you have to time it right. Sometimes Mother Nature doesn't cooperate with you with the timing, and the fall rains will come later, or they'll come too early when the rest of your crop is still in. You can irrigate to get the timing right. You have to keep the soil completely moist while it's germinating. Once it's germinated, you can let it dry out in between, especially because it'll be cooler, and so you don't need to water as often. But you still need to pay attention to dry spells. And if we do have a dry spell, which oftentimes we do in January in particular, is a pretty dry month most often. So, you know, giving it a good drench once a week or so, even when it's cold, you don't really need much more than that. Well, that will really help the cover crop thrive, and you'll get the most out of it.
So I guess ideal planting time for this, really, it depends on the weather, but basically sometime between Labor Day and Halloween.
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty safe. I mean, you don't want to get your summer crops out too soon, because you want to really, you know, maximize how much you get out of them. But then there comes to be a point where, you know, those tomatoes, while you may still have some green tomatoes on the plant, if the tomato is really suffering and not looking very healthy, you got to pull it out sooner rather than later, because otherwise you're just inviting pest problems.
Peaceful Valley has a wide array of cover crops and cover crop mixes, and you can check out what they have online at groworganic.com. It's all about cover cropping. Sarah Griffin Bubakar is the product development manager at Peaceful Valley Farm Supply. Sarah, good talking with you, and happy cover cropping.
Thanks. You too, Fred.
Thanks for listening to the KSTE Farm Hour, heard every Sunday from noon until 1 p.m. Pacific Time, and available anytime as a podcast at kste.com.